My name is Roy Malloy, and I'm here today on The Dawn of Crime talking to a fantastically intelligent and interesting historian named David Waldron. Has a lot of experience as an author and at an academic level in history. David has been very good and very kind and patient as I try and work out how to open a Zoom meeting. Not my forte, the actual technology part of it, but I'm very grateful to the assistance of many of my children who have helped me learn how to use Zoom. David is going to be talking to us today a little bit about one of the most interesting things I think I've ever come across in history. And I'll let David jump straight into it, but I've always been fascinated by Goldfield's history. I think that it's really it's our closest link to a Wild West frontier. It's in a time of history where it was almost lawless, but people just, when there's no law and there's no systems and there's no society or civilization really, people do the weirdest things. And we're going to talk a little bit about that today. Welcome, David.
Welcome.
And tell me a little bit about your work in this area.
So, of course, I do a lot of work on the more Gothic side of Goldfield's history. People might also check out my podcast, Tales from Rat City, which looks at the darker side of the Ballarat Goldfields. And I thought today I might talk about something I've done a bit of research on and I find quite a bizarre, quirky bit of Australian history, the phenomenon of what they call playing the ghost. And if you jump onto Trove, which is a wonderful resource to get great anecdotes and things for stories, type in the phrase playing the ghost and you'll get quite a lot of these stories pop up. So what's playing the ghost? That is a phenomenon in the latter half of the 19th century where people would go out in ghost costumes, often quite elaborate and using things like glow-in-the-dark paint, and they'd scare each other. And they also commit crimes. So you have like a woman at Eagle Hawk who was stealing chickens while dressed as a ghost. You have a very sad incident on Eureka Street in Ballarat where a miner by the name of Frederick Parks was stabbed by a ghost that was assaulting a woman late at night on the street. And the ghost reportedly had streaks of phosphorus paint across himself, dressed like in grey soiled clothes with a coffin lid strapped to his back and claw hands. A figure called the Ballarat Joe Ghost haunted through the rooftops doing a bit of parkour across Mare Street and Lydiard Street, jumping down and then attacking himself, but also exposing himself to women at night. And his outfit consisted of a glow-in-the-dark bodysuit, knee-high Indian rubber boots, a long white frock coat, and a white slouch hat with feathers and a mask.
Does any of this relate to or inspired by Spring-Heeled Jack?
This is an imitation of Spring-Heeled Jack, quite deliberately. You'll get stories of Spring-Heeled Jack impersonators around Bendigo, Ballarat, Castlemaine and other cities. And it's quite consciously so, where they've gone out and they've constructed their own persona and their own costume and off they go, imitating the ghost.
And do we have an idea? I'm not a very big conspiracy theorist. I do know they happen because when we find out about them, we call them cartels. But I tend to find that, you know, if you and I do something dodgy, if I say to you, David, let's steal something, the two of us, it probably won't get found out because you'll keep the secret, I'll keep the secret. If it gets out, it's you, right? We bring a third person into that and it's almost unmanageable. So then there's this secondary theory that if you do something dodgy, but you do it in a way that is so unbelievable, but when the police get there, they go, oh, sure, Elvis Presley just robbed your convenience store. Mm-hmm. It's kind of along those lines that they think, if I dress as a ghost, A, I won't be recognisable, but B, no one's going to believe them.
Well, I think certainly not being recognisable is part of it. And the darker side of this story is quite a number of these people are committing assault and sexual assault while dressed as a ghost, which I think led to one commentator have the line of real rape ghost is a lot scarier than fake rape ghost is a lot scarier than a real ghost, which maybe you might have a point. So there is certainly that element, like you're seeing the ghost, you're not seeing the woman stealing the chickens, you're seeing the ghost at night. The other thing to consider too is this is quite a transition period where belief in the supernatural is still quite strong, and there's also a tradition of denigrating the superstitious beliefs as they saw it of the Irish in particular. So there's another element as well, that if you can scare someone and get them to believe in ghosts just for a moment, you've won a victory against the intelligentsia who are telling you that such things are you know, superstitious nonsense to be stamped out by education. And there's certainly a lot of people concealing their identity. Another side to this is it's an outlet and an escape from oppressive Victorian morality. You have, you know, a lady going through the old cemetery dressed in glow-in-the-dark paint with her left breast exposed. Something she could never do normally, but at night, there's this outlet where she can let loose and be in that kind of liminal in-between space where she has another identity.
Do we happen to have parallels of the same activity in other goldfields like Kalgoorlie?
There's a little bit in WA, but mostly in Victoria, and I think part of it too is just the timing of it. The other thing is there's a huge, this is like the high point of Gothic literature, so people are impersonating Gothic literature. And there's nothing to, you commented before about, you know, being so bizarre and never believe you. Quite a few of these people, when captured and arrested by the police, were found to be, you know, quite respectable members of society. You know, one was a school teacher, one was a noted elocutionist, teaching people to speak with a proper received English pronunciation. And sure, there they are at night, wandering around being a ghost.
Do we get any examples of, stand and deliver bush ranging style activity in this guise, or is it more hand-to-hand interpersonal assault?
Hand-to-hand personal assault and exposing oneself. There's a lot of assault on women, and there's one clever lady who saw the ghost accosted her, and she fell over and pretended to faint. And when the ghost came down close to her, she slashed him across the face with a knife she had hidden in her basket, that she could identify the next day with the knife cut.
We tend to, in this modern era, we tend to forget how prevalent indecent exposure was prior to everybody having a telephone with a camera. Mm-hmm. Gardens were really one of the first big inventions of a public space, just as on recreation. And the history on public exposure in that park, same time period, like daily. And then you get kind of that a period of trying to combat that. When do the police start to take this seriously?
Well, they do take it fairly seriously from quite earlier on, and you'll get some really interesting examples, like in Bendigo and Ballarat, for instance. The city council put out bounties for the capture of ghosts in the...
What kind of money?
Enter. About £5 for the capture of a ghost.
And what would £5 buy you? And what year and what would £5 buy me?
So one example, the £5 bounty was... 1904, given £100 or £200 a year would be considered a decent wage, that'd be the equivalent of a few thousand dollars in today's terms.
Yeah. Okay. Then do you get the full mobs or singular vigilantes?
Well, generally you get actually mobs out. And there's an incident in Bendigo at one point where a ghost who'd going around accosting people in Lake Verona had some... vigilantes saw him and they opened fire with shotguns, and to their dismay the ghost pulled a revolver and started returning fire, and a bystander was actually shot in the exchange. But just again, what are those problems of why should we police into the police?
Extraordinary. In the earlier part of this this phenomenon, what's the earliest accounts of this?
So the earliest accounts get are in the 1860s, and again it's concomitant with the establishment of national education. It's also concomitant with the proliferation of Gothic literature and cinema. Like, at the same time as you have this, when you have plays of Hamlet, all the discussion will be about the ghost and how realistic it will look. There's new technology coming out that makes ghosts look much more realistic, such as the Pepper's Ghost Illusion, and of course glow-in-the-dark paint, which comes out in Australia in about 1864, if I recall. They note too, some of the police methods made me quite laugh, but Ballarat at one point they took to capturing the ghost by getting the young constables out dressed as ladies of the night near the train station in the hope that the ghost would come down to expose himself and the constables could get him.
That's fantastic. So this kind of overlaps into the leadership of Chief Commissioner Cholmondeley. And he's a revolutionary guy. His invention of, his use of plainclothes policemen, the beginning of the Terrible Ten. I'm trying to remember, is it Appleby? He's one of the first policemen in that line of plainclothes Because prior to this, really, police, they had a set beat, they'd walk it, and it really was just a matter of the crooks going, right, he's gone, back to business. So dressing as women, that's a fascinating turn at a time when that wouldn't have been seen before.
Yeah, indeed. Of course, this is that whole transitional period of policing. That's why, the later part of the 19th century, characters like Sherlock Holmes become so prolific, because you start to get, for the first time, scientific, systemic policing. One of my favourite characters is a policeman from Ballarat. He's Montague Summons, who worked as a detective, joined the police force in 1888, I believe. He later went on to be head of criminal investigations in Melbourne for the state. And yeah, he was one of the, in Ballarat, earlier pioneers, bringing in things like medical specialists and so on to look at cases. Like, remembering the case of Louisa Crook, for instance, that he arrested, who, I love this story, she's in the jail, been sent to Melbourne jail. She became jealous of her husband's attentions to her female friends, so she poisoned them in their tea.
Far out. You've got to be...
You have to talk to your husband about his wandering eye instead, and that you're poisoning your friends.
Wow. Sentence-wise, were these cases sensationalised? One of these gets to court, that'd be as entertaining as anything else, wouldn't it?
Yes, they're certainly sensationalised. Most of them end up in the Petty Court Register, where there's not a lot of detail there, but you do find a lot of detail in the newspapers about them. But generally, Petty Court Register, they're in the rest of the things like, vagabondry. Patrick McLennan was called a rogue and a vagabond of the worst order. He was sentenced to a year's prison term in Ballarat Jail, for instance.
One of those amazing sentences we don't have anymore, and there's a suspected person, no visible means of legal support. Do we have anybody that any of these cases that they return to doing the same activity when released?
Now, generally speaking, I don't see come across. They're caught and then they're exposed and everyone's aware of them. One exception I do have was this woman who. She initially was going out at night dressed as a man and essentially impersonate being a man and engaging people in male conversation. And then she'd suddenly reveal herself to be a woman and run off. And she was arrested for indecent exposure, which gives some suggestion of what she was doing. Oh. But in any case, she ended up being arrested and then sent to the Ararat Lunatic Asylum. And when she came out, she took to dressing as a monster and hiding under the bridge and leaping out and attacking people in... glow in the dark sheet and what was described as a hideous paper mache mask.
Gosh.
colourful characters and stories and the thought they've gone into the costumes they've created. And...
It does make one remember, I don't know if you do, about, I'm thinking 3 years ago, so 2017, the clowns are coming. Do you remember you get people who are dressed as a... And look, clowns are... horrifying, terrifying emblems a lot of the time. As a man who ran circuses myself, clowns are terrifying. And these guys would stand as fully grown, men standing beside the road as clowns. But it's, it does remind me of that psychology in the individual person to want to do that.
I would actually say that the ghost phenomenon is close to identical to the scary clown phenomenon. It's just these different pop culture literature that they're drawing on and different symbols.
Yeah.
The high proliferation of Penny Dreadfuls in goth literature, they're instead reading things like Stephen King's It, which I think is perhaps one of the progenitors of that particular phenomenon.
Mm.
It's a very similar thing. Mike Dash actually has a view as well regarding the English experience of this, that in the 19th century, mid-1850s onwards, for the first time, you start getting a middle class and people with significant leisure time. And there's not a lot of low-cost outlets to spend your leisure time. So doing things like this start to become a bit of a hobby, make your own fun, break out of the traditional norms and restrictions of daily life.
Interesting. Do we get any crossover where this kind of thing, I mean, you said that Gothic style literature and plays, Hamlet particularly, in the Goldfields, just prior to the rebellion, we see things like Pose de Plastique, which is a thing that came and went. It's where you get stationary women topless painted white as a statue and they pose in various forms. Yeah. But do we get any kinds of entertainment genre that crosses over into this ghost phenomena that is no longer with us, those quirky, interesting?
Not directly that I've seen, though. Like one lady, for instance, soaked a wedding dress in glow-in-the-dark paint. She painted herself like a porcelain doll and she got on top of the Sandhurst pub and played the guitar. Which to me, in my mind, you know, as a Gen X, it sounds very metal.
It's very, like, I mean, that's Beatles to the hilt, isn't it?
Rooftop. And making a statement, you know, some of this, there is that making a statement. But I think part of this also relates to the nature of ghosts and folklore, because in Australia in particular, we get very hung up on, we want a literal truth. Is your ghost real or not? We want validation of the supernatural. But ghosts in a folkloric sense, serve as the way communities memorialize trauma.
Yeah.
Traumatic experiences, murders, places where people have died in incarceration. As quite often, ghosts are created to symbolize or draw attention back to those sites of trauma. And one of Australia's most famous ghost stories, Fisher's Ghost, you know, is exactly that, of a ghost appearing on the same spot, you know, warning of where a man had been murdered was. You have people, one particular case called the Harton Hills Ghost. 1877, a man goes to sites where Gunjimara people and settlers have had conflict and acts as the ghost of a dead Gunjimara man on those sites. And it terrified people. And they have these huge posses going out trying to find the Harton Hills Ghost, as they call it. It turned out to be a woodcutter by the name of Robert Downey, and he said he just did it for a lark, but it's a very pointed lark to make.
Yeah. And when you talk about these crimes, there's a there's levels of cultural influence. Do we have a migrant group, bearing in mind that, well, actually, do we have any instances of First National people participating in this?
Not of First Nations people, though I have suspicions about Robert Downey. I just haven't found anything about him being a wandering woodcutter.
So then the next question is...
But he's certainly a lot of this with the Irish.
Irish?
Yeah, it's very strongly maintained with the Irish, and part of that's tied to rituals like keening and stories of banshees and so on that came to Australia with them.
And with these cases, we get a lot of instances where, from what I understand, you're saying people are identified, prosecuted. What's the height of severity for one of these cases? Who gets the harshest sentence?
People who commit physical assault.
Yeah. And what kind of
sentence? Sorry?
What kind of sentence?
Years jail, things like that. One man was flogged in Bunyong. But for the most part, it's things like a year's jail, hard labour, that kind of thing.
We don't get lynching hangings?
Well, the hangings and things come for the people who've done things like the ghost who assaulted and stabbed Frederick Parks, for instance, got quite a severe sentence. But he got the sentence for stabbing someone, whereas the playing the ghost part was seen as usually just a petty crime, being a nuisance or a vagabond, even if he did expose yourself.
I'd imagine in that time and place with arguably less education amongst the average person, do we get instances where someone is caught in the public street and they're dealt with on the spot by the mob?
That happened a lot. There's a lot of... Like Robert Downey, for instance, they talked about him being beaten within an inch of his life. There's a lot of physical assault by vigilantes, that kind of thing. One case, a lady took to a guy and severely injured him with her umbrella. A guy by the name of Charles Foreman was patrolling the Ballarat Cemetery with a shotgun loaded with rocks off. They had a few instances of him encountering ghosts around Ballarat Old Cemetery, opening fire. He's told the police that he was specifically aiming for their buttocks. And in the early days, they were encouraging vigilantism as a way of dealing with the ghost problem, but this started to become less popular when vigilantes started to injure people who were bystanders. And when they started bringing out firearms, it became quite problematic.
Game changer, isn't it? What kind of firearms would they have access to?
They usually talk about percussion cap shotguns. For the most part, though, in the incident in Bendigo, the youths had percussion cap shotguns and the ghost returned fire with a revolver.
And we're talking a similar era also to Jack the Ripper, that August of 1888.
Leading up to that period, yes, definitely.
Mm. We're talking about a time when literally every man, woman, and child had a knife of some description just as a utility.
Yep.
Fascinating stuff.
The way you find axe murders quite common because everyone had an axe, and if someone went off on a murder spree or in a fit of rage, an axe is the thing they grabbed for because every house would have one. It was just quite prolific. Well, the other thing too to consider in this period is you don't really have, until the later part of the 19th century, 1880s even, policing as we think of it today. As I said before, police had their set beats. The idea of even fingerprints comes in quite late, in the late 1880s. The idea of forensics in policing is coming in quite late. And so actually having police deal with these sort of matters is a lot more difficult than it would be today.
Fascinating. And as we kind of come to an end of your research into this, what would your advice be to anybody that is looking to replicate this in their own world?
I think if you're interested in authenticity with the costumes and so on, if you go to Illustrated Police News, there's some wonderful illustrations of it that I suggest people look at. They're gorgeous woodcut images. And well, it's regarded as, I think the term was, the world's worst newspaper as in terms of sensationalist tabloid rubbish. It has wonderful illustrations of costumes and outfits and things like that. Much the same with the Melbourne Illustrated Police News, which was illustrated by Egan Lee. So go and have a look at that for the costuming. But the descriptions in the paper are quite vivid and quite specific and usually consisted of clothes soaked in glow-in-the-dark paint. Their paint was toxic, and I love the irony of covering yourself in toxic paint to try and pretend to be someone who's dead. But you can get non-toxic glow-in-the-dark paint from Bunnings. And when I was researching this for some papers, some friends and I actually went and replicated some of the costumes with non-toxic glow-in-the-dark paint to see what they look like.
Please say you have this on YouTube.
Not on YouTube, but I have photos we took.
That is amazing. Can you remind us the name of your podcast?
Yes, Tales from Rat City.
And where can people find you on other social platforms?
On Facebook is Tales from Rat City, talesfromratcity.com on the internet, and for my own page, of course, on Facebook and Twitter under David Waldron.
Mr. David Waldron, your details will also be in the summary of this podcast on Anchor, where I house my stuff. Thank you so much for taking the time. This has been the dawn of crime, which is just the joy of my life right now. This has been one of the most discussions I've ever had. I look forward to hearing from anybody with comments in the under part. And thank you again, David.
Cheers. No worries. Anytime.